This is Greg Oliar, the author of Dirty Rubles, and you're listening to Mueller, She Wrote.
So to be clear, Mr. Trump has no financial relationships with any Russian oligarchs.
That's what he said. That's what I said. That's obviously what our position is.
I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians.
What do I have to get involved with Putin for? I have nothing to do with Putin. I've never spoken to him. I don't know anything about him other than he will respect me. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing.
So, it is political. You're a communist.
No, Mr. Green. Communism is just a red herring. Like all members of the oldest profession, I'm a capitalist.
Hello, and welcome to Mueller, She Wrote, Volume 2. I'm your host, AG, but you can call me Allison Gill now, and you can follow me under my real name on Twitter, at Allison Gill. I would love it if you did. We have a lot to cover today, though we are still in a holding pattern in many ways, in many respects. But we're going to go over some news about the McGahn testimony that happened on Friday. I have an update on Pecker. That's right. Our friend Pecker is back in the news. I have an update on the New York investigation into the Trump Organization. And I have some sabotage, of course, and the Fantasy Indictment League. And I'm honored to be joined later in the show by former Watergate prosecutor Jill Wine Banks. We're going to go over this McGahn testimony and what it could mean. But first, we have a lot of news to get to. So let's do it. Let's jump in with just the facts. So the headline in the New York Times reads, quote, a tabloid publisher will pay $187,500 FEC penalty for its Trump hush money payment. I love when they act like we have no idea who or what they're talking about. As we know, David Pecker, right, CEO of American Media, Inc., you've selected Pecker, an AMI, which is American Media, Inc., owns the National Enquirer. They bought the rights to Karen McDougal's story about her affair with Trump in a catch and kill scheme for $150,000, right? So she had this whole story. She's a former Playboy bunny. She had an affair with Trump. And they bought the rights to her story like they were going to publish it. And they gave her $150,000 and then they just killed the story. That's a catch and kill. American Media, Inc. actually tried to defend itself by telling the FEC that silence is not a thing of value. That thing that they paid $150,000 for is worthless. The $187,500 fine is part of a settlement between AMI and the FEC. But get this, here's the buried lead. Mr. Trump himself faces no further investigation in relation to the payment to Ms. McDougal. Documents released on Tuesday by Common Cause, which is a government watchdog group which filed the initial complaint with the FEC, said that the FEC did not have sufficient votes from its commissioners to move forward with an inquiry looking into Trump's role in the catch and kill. The six-member commission was obviously, we've talked about this before, it's divided between three Republican-aligned commissioners and three Democratically-aligned ones. And just last month, we learned the FEC killed the Stormy Daniels hush money investigation into Trump. In that case, the commission's professional staff recommended proceeding in its review, but Republican commissioners disagreed, saying it was not the best use of agency resources. Campaign finance violations. Republicans think that they're not a good use of time for the FEC. One Democrat on the commission, Ellen Weintraub, who is very outspoken and I love, said on Tuesday that she voted to pursue Trump further in the McDougal case and noted that the commission had found that the illegal contributions were made in coordination with the campaign. Quote, I would think it would also be illegal to be received, she said, but she was outvoted. Again, I want to know what this vote is made up of. I'm going to wait to see. I've been searching. If you know, send it to me at ag@mullershewrote.com and you put FEC in the subject line. If you know how they voted, because I know how they voted on the Stormy Daniels one. And one of the Democrats wasn't even there. I want to know what happened again. And I don't understand this. I really don't understand it. Southern District of New York, if you're listening, please reopen this investigation. You closed it under pressure. Under bar. Reopen it. Nothing stopping you. And from Politico this week, Natalie Mayflower Sowers Edwards, a former senior Treasury Department official, was sentenced Thursday to 6 months in prison for leaking thousands of confidential reports on suspect financial transactions. Her leaks from the Treasury Department, where she worked, fueled reports in BuzzFeed on issues related to the Mueller investigation. And those are the ties between the Trump campaign and Russia, as well as a series by news organizations across the globe last summer, ICIJ, examining why banks around the world continue to do business with clients who regularly engaged in suspicious activity. And by suspicious activity, they mean money laundering, among other things. The sentencing in a high-profile leak case came just hours after the Justice Department disclosed that it seized phone records and sought email metadata from four New York Times journalists as a part of a series of leak investigations initiated during the Trump administration. This all comes from the Trump administration, just so you know. Edwards pleaded guilty last year to conspiring to violate the Bank Secrecy Act by disclosing more than 2,000 SARS, suspicious activity reports. Remember those? That banks and other financial institutions confidentially file with the Treasury Department. And that's the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN. We've talked about this so much, so many times on the show. We reported heavily on the SARS that she leaked. I think she's a fucking hero. I don't get how Manafort, Stone, Flynn, Trump Jr. et al. Walk free while people like Reality Winner and Natalie Mayflower Sowers Edwards spend not just time in prison, but so much time in prison. Papadopoulos got 14 days and she gets 6 months. Vanderswan got 30 days and Reality Winner has been in prison for years. It just makes no sense to me. Equal justice under the law on my ass. And yes, I understand Manafort and Stone and Flynn were pardoned. And yes, I understand leaking government documents is a crime. Trust me, I'm on that side. You've heard me talk about it. But when we step back and look at who is in prison and who is not, the system isn't working. Edwards delivered an 8-minute statement to the court saying she could not stand by aimlessly in the face of misconduct, the misconduct she saw at the Treasury Department. She also suggested FBI agents violated her rights by questioning her after she asked for an attorney. Only at the very end of her statement did she offer a note of contrition. She said, "I understand and I accept that a lot of information was made available to the public. I do apologize for that, Your Honor." Don't be sorry. And from the Washington Post, former President Donald Trump's company has again hired a broker to sell its lease at the D.C. hotel. That's according to two people familiar with the discussions. This is the second attempt to unload the property after the pandemic thwarted it the first time. And, you know, Trump being Trump himself, that helps. The Trump Organization previously listed the Pennsylvania Avenue Hotel in the federally owned old post office pavilion in the fall of 2019. When COVID-19 hit, many hotels closed their doors completely or partially due to government shutdowns, and the company pulled the property off the market. Now, with Trump under investigation by... This is a quote. "Now, with Trump under investigation by prosecutors in New York and the economy beginning to take off, his company is trying again, hiring the brokerage firm Newmark Group to market the lease, according to the people who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Trump currently leases the building from the GSA." Isn't that a special little conflict of interest? I'm sure no one's looking into that since the GSA halted the FBI move so no one could move in and compete with Trump's hotel. I'm sure nobody's looking at that. Rooms were running nearly half empty the last time the company put it up for sale. And last year, the revenue of the property fell by 62%. According to Trump's government disclosure forms. Oh, Trump filled out those forms. Okay. But wait, what's that line they snuck in a minute ago? They said, quote, "Now with Trump under investigation and the economy beginning to take off." Now with Trump under investigation. What's that got to do with it? Could it be that perhaps maybe Cy Vance and Tish James are looking into it? I know for a fact that the D.C. Attorney General, Carl Racine, is looking into the inaugural as well as Tish James. And the inaugural is important with the D.C. hotel because they oversold everything. And remember how Wolkoff was like, how are we going to this? They're going to audit this. How are we going to say that this is market value? It's not. Tom Barrack is wrapped up in that. He's an old Fantasy Indictment League favorite. And I'm all but certain that the D.C. hotel is definitely part of his criminal enterprise. I have a feeling we'll know more this summer. Should the hotel sell, by the way, it would likely mean the name Trump would come down from the building, leaving tourists with nothing to flip off in photos. How many of I have a photo of that. I don't know if you have a photo of that. We should get a thread going on that. People flipping off Trump buildings. I know there's a lot out there. In addition to the difficulty of reaching a wide array of guests, hotel management has not reopened the hotel's outdoor bar seating out of concerns for the comfort and safety of guests. I think by concerns for the comfort and safety of guests, they mean out of concern that we have no guests. I hope he gets fucked on the sale. No one wants to do business with him. And he's got a $170 million loan out from Deutsche Bank on this building. It's coming due. And a foreclosure would be pretty fun. All right, on to the next story. The U.S. Army said Wednesday that it will not investigate former General Michael Flynn for statements he recently made, which he appeared to endorse a Myanmar-style coup occurring in the United States. Quote, we are aware of the statements Flynn made May 30th and June 1st. The Army is not investigating these statements further at this time. At this time. That's an Army spokesperson said, speaking in a statement. Given the fact that Flynn is retired, the Army's decision is in line with the U.S. military's typical approach to similar situations. When potential misconduct carried out by retired members who are out of uniform does not prompt an investigation by the armed services. But it's possible. Flynn is facing bipartisan criticisms after appearing to endorse a coup in Dallas on Sunday. Currently, retirees can be recalled for court-martial, though our friend Steve Vladek, who we've had on the show a few times or on the Daily Beans a few times, is fighting this in court to have that changed. And I agree with him. But not for sedition or treason. I think there needs to be a carve-out for that. Again, I feel like I'm looking at two systems of justice here. Because let me tell you about my brief history with the Uniform Code of Military Justice and court-martial and content warning for sexual assault. When I tried to report my rape, I was, first of all, they did all the old typical, you know, were you drinking? What were you wearing? Were you flirting? You know, kind of victim blamey stuff. And then somebody came in and started threatening me of the woes and perils of filing a false report of rape. I was bleeding, wearing a blanket. But if I filed a false report, I could be kicked out, dishonorably discharged, lose all my benefits, lose my rank, lose my rate. I would be court-martialed because, not because, for committing adultery. Court-martialed for adultery because my rapist was married. I wasn't married. That was the threat, that I would face court-martial for adultery because my rapist was married. But General Flynn can call a fucking coup and everything's cool. Two systems. All right. Anyway, enough of that. Let's turn the corner for some good news. The controller and senior vice president of the Trump Organization, Jeff McConney, is testifying before the new special grand jury impaneled by the Manhattan District Attorney, Cy Vance. And he's just one of many, they say. And this is important because it means McConney isn't a target. If you've been listening to the Daily Beans, you'll remember a discussion I had with Ellie Honig about the differences between New York state and federal grand juries. I also discussed it with Andrew Torres on Cleanup on L45 this past Wednesday, but with regards to Ellen Weisselberg. In a New York state grand jury, you get immunity when you testify, which means you're cooperating or you aren't a target, or both. And if the decades-long controller, decades he spent in that job being the controller and a senior vice president of the Trump Organization, isn't a target, that doesn't leave too much room at the top, does it? It's pretty much Weisselberg up from there. I'm waiting on Weisselberg to be spotted headed into the grand jury. I have beans. I think he's already flipped. That's based on really nothing other than the fact that Vance impaneled the special grand jury. I don't think he would have done that and made an announcement if he were going after Weisselberg, and I don't think he'd be going after Trump if Weisselberg weren't cooperating. That's just my feeling, but I think they've secured, and again, don't run with this. I'm not news on this. I have no source for this whatsoever. These are just beans. Don't run and tell everybody, hey, Weisselberg flipped, because there's no evidence of that. It's just a feeling that I have, please. Well, AG said so. Hey, it's conjecture, right? Remember? Remember the good old conjecture? But yeah, if he's spotted going into that special grand jury room to testify, he's cooperating, Weisselberg. But anyway, we'll know. If we spot Weisselberg going in, we'll know. They're after Trump and his kids and the organization as a whole. They could get him under Little RICO, which is like federal RICO statute, but it's for New York business practices, where if you have three crimes committed in the furtherance of making more money for your business illegally, you might be a RICO. You might be little RICO. And I'm sure they can find three crimes. I can name three off the top of my head. And finally, McGahn testified to the House Judiciary Committee for over 8 hours on Friday. And despite the agreement saying, you know, they did this whole agreement, you know, limiting the scope and the breadth, saying they can only ask questions and you can only answer questions about the stuff in the publicly available portions, not even the redacted parts, the publicly available portions of the Mueller report. By the way, they did this because they didn't want Trump to try to exert some sort of privilege, because Trump released the Mueller report. So that waives any kind of privilege claim over McGahn. But both Jerry Nadler and Madeleine Dean told reporters that there was new information. They gleaned new information, not before known, that, quote, shed new light on troubling events. We know he's testifying about the obstruction of justice, Trump's obstruction of justice, because Trump tried to get McGahn to fire Mueller and then had him write up a memo saying he never said that. So that's totally fucking obstruction of justice. So what are they going to do with it? What's Merrick Garland going to, are the Judiciary Dems going to make a referral to the Department of Justice, a criminal referral, that then Merrick Garland would have to ignore if he doesn't feel like prosecuting? Because those are fucking crimes. Federal obstruction of justice, meeting all three. And he knows that. So we'll see. I'm going to chat with Jill Winebanks about that after this quick break. Stay with us. Hey everybody, it's AG, and this episode of Mueller, She Wrote is brought to you by Helix Sleep. You've heard me over the years sing the praises of my Helix mattress. Jordan loves hers. Mandy and Joelle say it's the best mattress they've ever had. And I have to agree, I have never slept better, and it's not just because we got the Orange Menace out of the White House. It's because Helix knows you have unique sleep preferences, and they created an online sleep quiz designed to match you with the perfect mattress for your preferences, for your unique taste. I was matched with the Helix Midnight because I'm a side sleeper and I like a medium firm bed, so it's perfect for me. But you don't have to take my word for it, or Jordan's, or Mandy's, or Joelle's. Helix was awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 and 2019 and 2020 by GQ and Wired Magazine. And Helix has been recommended by multiple leading chiropractors and doctors of sleep medicine as a go-to solution for improving sleep. And they're right. They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it for 100 sleeps risk-free. And they'll come pick it up if you don't love it, but you will. Just go to helixsleep.com/MSW, take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and Helix will match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. And right now, Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners at helixsleep.com/MSW. That's helixsleep.com/MSW for up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I am honored today to be joined by author of The Watergate Girl, host of the Sisters-in-Law podcast, and she's a contributor on MSNBC, and she was a Watergate and federal prosecutor. Please welcome Jill Winebanks. Jill, hello. Welcome to Mueller, She Wrote.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
It's good to see you. I haven't seen you in person since we did that Politicon panel together, and I don't think we've talked since pre-pandemic time, so it's great to have you back.
I can't wait for Politicon to have live events again. That would be so much fun. I enjoyed it. And we had a great audience for that. And I'm sure you have a great audience for this podcast.
And the reason I wanted to bring you on today is because we've got, the Mueller, She Wrote podcast went dark for about a year because nothing was going on. Bill Barr was in charge of everything and we were trying to win an election. So we're back now because all of this Mueller stuff is starting to bubble up to the surface again. It's hard to keep the truth buried. And McGahn testified finally to the House Judiciary today. And I was curious as to your thoughts on, because Rep. Madeleine Dean just went on CNN and said he did actually say something new, reveal some new information. We should be seeing the transcript from that testimony in about a week. And I don't know if it'll be redacted or not, but I'm very interested to find out. But I was sort of wanted your thoughts on why, if he was just sort of agreeing to testify to the publicly available portions of the Mueller report in Volume 2, what was the point of this exercise?
Well, I'm very curious as to what Madeleine Dean said about something new, because we were all expecting it to be exactly what we already knew about his being asked to do certain things that I would consider highly improper and illegal, possibly obstruction of justice, his refusing to do it, but being asked to do it by the President of the United States at that time, now the former president. So I don't know what he could have added that's new, because the terms that were negotiated did limit his testimony to what he had already told in the public parts of the Mueller report. Well, the public parts of the Mueller report, we all know, so there's nothing new to be added. But here's the reason why you would do it anyway, even if you're not going to learn. And that is to confirm the power of Congress to issue subpoenas and have them validated and valued and answered, to allow what I would call the oversight function to work. And that's very important, because we have three co-equal branches. And one of the rules and one of the most significant roles for Congress is to oversee the functioning of the executive branch. And if they cannot subpoena anyone from the executive branch, they can't fulfill that duty. And during the Trump administration, it wasn't just Don McGahn who didn't testify. And it wasn't just testimony that was withheld in criminal investigations like Don McGahn's, but it was people who were knowledgeable about what was happening about children in cages. Let's not forget that horrible episode in our history. People in charge of that weren't allowed to come and testify, and the White House got away with it. And so having a confirmation that Congress can issue subpoenas and they will be honored is an important thing. And it was worth having him come, if only for that one purpose.
So regardless of whether or not the judiciary Dems make a criminal referral of obstruction to the Department of Justice, and if they do, whether or not, regardless of whether or not Merrick Garland intends to or pursues prosecution or investigation into obstruction of justice, the important part here is that now that he has testified, in the future, let's say we've got somebody in the White House who is telling people not to testify to Congress, then when Congress goes to court, perhaps they'll be able to more quickly expedite that, use this instance as an argument to expedite the issuance and compliance with those subpoenas. Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying. And also it avoids having to continue the litigation going to court and getting a decision that could end up being sort of a cop-out in a way, saying, well, he's not president anymore, and so the issue is moot. And that would leave us absolutely nowhere. This, therefore, advances the cause of getting future witnesses. So you have it completely correct.
Awesome. That's really, really good news. And I think Madeline Dean had brought up the fact that there was some legislation actually introduced in 2019 for expediting congressional subpoenas. And now that this, you know, when we see this transcript redacted or not, that might breathe new life, hope perhaps bipartisan new life, because, you know, I don't know that the Republicans are going to vote for anything. Maybe breathe new life into this particular legislation.
I'm actually one of those people who has been extremely optimistic, Pollyanna almost, and even I am beginning to lose any hope that even President Biden, who could not be a person of more centrist views, a person more committed to bipartisanship, I can't think of anyone more committed to it, and even he has not been able to get Republicans to even consider reasonable things. So whether there is ever bipartisanship in the immediate future, I'm not so confident anymore.
Now, now that I have you, just while I have you here for a minute, I want to ask you about your thoughts about this new Department of Justice and kind of the, I don't know, small C conservative stance they're taking on releasing the entirety of the Bill Barr memo, or the fact that he hasn't just picked up and run with obstruction of justice charges or Manafort charges, that, you know, things he wasn't pardoned for that he definitely did. But there are some other things that we're seeing. The Rudy Giuliani case was allowed to go forward. They appointed a special master today. Same special master as Cohen, as a matter of fact, which is funny.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I worked Judge with her Jones. At the Pentagon. Yes, she was chair of a committee looking at sexual assault in the military.
that's one of my red flag causes. So I tell her I appreciate that if you speak with her. So what are your thoughts on this particular Department of Justice? Because, you know, we've talked to Joyce Vance about this at length and how accountability is like step one to restoring faith in the Justice Department. I'm personally a little disappointed, but maybe I'm being impatient.
I think you're not alone. Many people are disappointed and many people don't understand. I think they have been very cautious at the Department of Justice to take institutional perspective into account and to protect what has always been their guiding principles. So in recognition of executive privilege, for example, which is a legitimate privilege, it is something that is completely appropriate. It was used inappropriately by the Trump administration and they tried to convert it basically to absolute immunity, which is a non-existent something. So I think they're being careful and trying to protect those institutional interests that have a legitimate reason to exist, and which, in fact, this administration may want to use themselves because it is a legitimate way to encourage getting advice and policy information without having people afraid that their advice will be publicly released. So I think they're being careful, and it's understandable. There are some times when they're going to have to say, well, in this case, transparency, I started to say trumps all else, and maybe I should, that transparency is so important that certain things have to be revealed. But because the things, for example, that are redacted that haven't been released, we don't know what they are, and I don't know what they're protecting. So because I trust Merrick Garland, another native of Illinois, and in fact of the high school that I went to, although he's much younger and so went much after I did, I would say that I trust them to be making wise decisions that will allow the truth to come out and justice to be pursued, and to go back to, honestly, the Watergate era when democracy worked and justice prevailed and bipartisanship actually was a very real thing that actually worked and got results. And again, when it came to subpoenas, there was a difference even back then between the subpoena that we as prosecutors issued and the subpoena that the Congress issued for other purposes. And it's important to keep in mind that for investigations of criminality, the courts are much more willing to uphold the subpoena than for congressional legislative purposes.
Yeah, and I get it. I mean, I understand the importance of the deliberative process privilege, which is what they were arguing here at this particular DOJ about why they didn't release the second half of that Barr memo. And I get that. And I also get that what they did release was incredibly damning. And everyone just sort of glossed over that, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
But, you know, I do have confidence in Merrick Garland, but I also have confidence in Judge Berman Jackson, whose opinion was pretty airtight and who I also implicitly trust to get it right. So I just thought the Department of Justice's argument was weird when they said, well, what Barr really meant was this. And if he meant what we think he really meant, then this is why we don't want to release it. And it just, but you're right. We don't know. I mean, we can make really good guesses about what's under those redaction bars, but we don't know. And without knowing, it's really kind of hard to speculate about the legal ramifications of it. But I'm on the side of Judge Jackson, and we'll see how it goes in appellate court. Just because the DOJ is appealing this doesn't mean that the DOJ is going to win.
It's exactly right. And because we don't know, it makes it hard for me to speculate. Obviously, I want to see the whole thing. And it's not idle curiosity that makes me want to see it. But again, I trust when the Department of Justice says, well, Judge, you misinterpreted not so much that she misinterpreted, that the Department of Justice lawyers before us misspoke. They weren't clear in their communications. And this was part of the deliberative process, even though it was being done simultaneously. It is a recording of the oral advice that he was being given at that time in advance of, so that it was part of the deliberative process. And the deliberative process is an important thing to protect. So there's no reason why the current administration would claim that it was part of the deliberative process, given the strength of the words and the persuasive power that they had over you and me, and probably everybody else who read her opinion, that if it wasn't really true that there had been some miscommunication, some lack of clarity on the part of the lawyers who wrote the original memos or the original briefs to the judge.
Yeah, the only reason I could think of is if there's really no appetite to prosecute anyone from the former administration and everybody wants to return to normalcy, then, you know, maybe if you reveal that second half of that memo, you might have to. But that doesn't seem like something that this particular Department of Justice would do. It doesn't seem like a Merrick Garland type of a situation. But again, I guess we just can't know. But I am interested to see what the Justice Dems, the Judiciary Dems do with this McGahn testimony, whether it's to forward the idea of congressional subpoenas being honored in court next time, perhaps, or whether it's to actually make a criminal referral to the Department of Justice and see how Merrick Garland handles it. I'm interested to see what happens.
It is. And let me just add, I am a person who believes that a former president can be indicted. I also believe a sitting president can be indicted. But that's an irrelevant discussion now. The relevant discussion is, can a former president? And the answer is clearly yes. He's an ordinary citizen and he has no special rights or privileges. He is not above the law. And so if he committed crimes, even if you agree with the Office of Legal Counsel memo that says a sitting president shouldn't be, and I'm going to use the word shouldn't instead of can't, be indicted, that argument falls flat right now because there's no interruption in his service as president. He can do, you know, he's done doing that job. And so he can spend time defending himself in a criminal case.
Yeah. And that's why I specifically wanted to speak to you about this, because, you know, Watergate went through all that. And then, of course, Ford pardons Nixon. And then that has something to do with where we are today, because people are being let off the hook. And I think letting people off the hook sets a really bad precedent. And I know you agree.
I definitely agree. I believe that had Richard Nixon been indicted as soon as he resigned, that possibly a message would have been sent to a president like Trump that you can't get away with it. And he didn't get that message, obviously.
And if it didn't send the message to Trump, because Trump doesn't listen very well, it would have at least set the precedent that we don't do this. And it wouldn't be outrageous to indict a former or sitting president.
Well, hopefully we aren't going to have any other presidents who behave in a way that requires that you think about, can a sitting president or a former president be indicted?
Hopefully, but the way these voter suppression bills are going, I am a little bit worried. I want to, before I let you go, ask you about Watergate Girl. I think that this is, it's out, available in paperback now.
It is.
The Boston Globe says, riding the crest of the Me Too movement, Wine Banks describes the mostly workday sexism she encountered on the job. The book's fast-moving narrative and crisp prose should hook readers. So I always wondered about this before your book came out, what it must have been like to be a female federal prosecutor at the time of Watergate.
Well, let's look at statistics. Back then, less than 4% of all lawyers were women. And of that small percentage, almost none were prosecutors or even litigators, even civil litigators. So it was something where no one quite knew how to treat a female who happened to be a trial lawyer and particularly a federal prosecutor. And that was true when I was in the organized crime section and then during Watergate as well. It was, I'd walk into a courtroom and the clerk would say, "Whose secretary are you?" And it sort of explains the name of the book, because when that was first suggested, I said, no way am I going to have a book come out with my name as the author that says Watergate Girl. And titles are selected by, and the cover photo is selected by the publisher. And my editor said to me, and he's fabulous. I mean, he could not have been a more helpful editor. He said, well, what describes the era better than girl? And the minute he said that, I thought about all the stories that are actually in the book where someone said to me, you can't do that. You're a girl. You can't try a case because you'd be more vulnerable in a courtroom because you're a girl. And so I was called girl. I was also called the mini-skirted lawyer. And headlines would have that description of me. And oftentimes news stories would describe what I was wearing before it talked about what I said. So I think Watergate Girl, I've now come to actually love the title. It feels quite right. And you mentioned the paperback book, and it is such a small, you can see it. I know this is not video, but since I'm seeing you and you're seeing me, the paperback is this nice cuddly thing that really feels like the intimate story that Watergate Girl is. And it is a very personal, very intimate story. And so it was particularly designed so you could obviously fit it in basically a big pocket or a briefcase easily. And it's easy to read sitting in bed, which is I love how it looks and feels. And just, it's been optioned for a movie or a TV series by Katie Holmes, who is going to play me. And so it's in a very exciting place right now as I talk to her and writers about what the screenplay will be. It's quite an exciting part of my life right now.
That's so awesome. And you know, I think so many women can relate to your story. I know me personally, when I first arrived in the Navy, I was one of the first handful of women in the nuclear program. And when I got there, they thought I was part of the, quartermasters, or I was a maid or running something. And I'm like, nope, here for nuke school. And they're like, what? And they just didn't know what to do with me, and they didn't know how to act. And a lot of similar stories. So I really encourage everyone to read this book. You can get it everywhere you get your books.
Yeah.
And you need to listen to the Sisters-in-Law podcast as well.
And iGen Politics. Let's not forget that one, which I do. That's an interview format where an 18-year-old and I give intergenerational perspectives, and we've interviewed some of the most interesting people ever, from heroes of mine like Madeleine Albright to we just interviewed the acting Secretary of Defense during the last 3 months of the Trump administration, Chris Miller, and I think you'll love that one. You'll find it quite interesting. And so... Both podcasts are absolutely amazing. And I did write the book to be a personal story and to share it in a way. I wrote it as if I was talking to friends, because I feel like it is a universal story that many women have experienced and are still experiencing. And I know that I learn from other people's memoirs and biographies and autobiographies about how to handle tough situations by how did people who succeeded do it. And so I thought it was worth sharing some of those stories for that reason.
Yeah, 100%. And I encourage everybody to pick it up. Thank you so much for
today
and your insights. It's been, you're a gem, you're a national treasure, Jill Winebanks. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, AG.
Everybody stick around, we'll be right back. Hey everybody, this episode of Mueller, She Wrote is all about getting a good night's rest. This segment is brought to you by Rise, which is a science-based app that makes it easy to improve your sleep and your daily energy. Here at MSW, we love anything science-based, and we also love sleep. Sleep is as essential as air and water, but there's lots of misinformation out there. Did you know it's normal to feel groggy in the morning and sluggish in the afternoon, but that it's not normal to feel tired throughout the day? That's an indication you're carrying something called sleep debt. I just learned about this in the Rise app by Sleep Debt. Sleep Debt is the only sleep score that matters, and Rise tracks how much sleep you owe your body relative to your own unique sleep needs, and then it helps you pay it back. You pay back your sleep debt. Your circadian rhythm dictates your personal energy peaks and dips throughout the day. Rise not only predicts your daily energy schedule, it helps you control it. So I've been using the Rise app to calculate my sleep debt, and after just a few small adjustments in the first week I've had it, my energy throughout the day is noticeably better. Every morning, Rise tells you how long you'll be groggy, when your best focus times will be, and that's when I tend to schedule my more heady meetings, you know, and do some of my writing, and then when you should start winding down for better sleep. Rise helps you realize your potential with real results, real productivity, real performance, real well-being. 80% of Rise users feel the benefits within 5 days. Give it a try and see what it can do for you. Go to risescience.com/MSW and you download the Rise app today. Try it free for 7 days. Whether you want to become a morning person, wake up more refreshed, be less exhausted during the day, or improve your productivity and daily energy, Rise is the power behind your next best day. That's risescience.com/MSW to try the Rise app free for 7 days. All right, welcome back. Are you ready for sabotage? U.S. District Court Judge J. Paul Oatkin ruled Friday that the prosecutor's request that a special master be appointed to go through everything seized in the Rudy and Tonesig raid is not only granted, that request for a special master is granted, but the special master, they got the one they wanted. It's retired Judge Barbara Jones. Remember how I discussed the parallels between the Rudy Giuliani raid and the Michael Cohen raid, right? They're both Trump's personal lawyers. They're both criminals. They were both raided at their homes and offices. They were both raided in the month of April. One was in 2018 and one was in 2020. They'd both require a special master. And if the name Barbara Jones sounds familiar, that's because she is the same special master that was appointed in the Cohen case to go through all of Cohen's files and decide what was privileged and what was not. Cohen was indicted in August, by the way, raided in April, indicted in August. So I'm just going to mark my calendar. August Rudy for the Fantasy Indictment League.
I'm gonna be indicted!
No, wait, it's gonna be okay.
Indicted!
Honey, Dick.
Indicted!
Honey.
I'm gonna be indicted!
Hold it, they can't. It's gonna be okay. Just calm down.
I can't calm down. I'm gonna be indicted!
All right, this week for my Fantasy Indictment League, I know that the special grand jury was just impaneled and we haven't seen Weisselberg sneaking in and out of there, but I'm gonna put Trump in there anyway. I'm gonna put Gates. I think he's going to go down for that obstruction of justice. And I went over that on the I'm going to go over that on the Daily Beans tomorrow morning. But Gates is in trouble for obstruction of justice. Actually, I went over it Friday on the Daily Beans. I did. And I used a Mean Girls clip, too. It was pretty great. So if you want to check out the information on that, listen to the Daily Beans from Friday. And then I'm going to add the Trump Organization, because I believe the Trump Organization can be indicted under the little RICO law. And I need to talk to Ellie Honig, because I need to find out if the organization is indicted, does that mean nobody goes to jail if just the organization is indicted? Or if just the organization is indicted under the little RICO law, are people implicated in that? Do they have to have separate indictments? I don't know how that works. I'm going to have to read up on that, and I'll let you know. I'll do some research and let you know. But I'm putting the Trump org on my fantasy indictment draft. I'm going to put Weisselberg down for a plea agreement. I think, you know, if we find out he's been going in and out of the special grand jury to testify, we'll know he's got a plea agreement going on, or at least some sort of partial immunity or immunity. And I'm going to put Ivanka on there. I'm going to put Ivanka on today. Now, I wish I had more slots on my team. I'd add Junior Eric. I'd add Derek Harvey, who they'd probably be trying to get to flip on Rudy Giuliani, and Tonesig into Geneva as well. So many to choose from. I think the Gates, my sources are telling me, and I'm reading in reporting, that the Gates indictment is probably July timeframe. So August, I'm guessing Rudy, July, Gates. It's going to be a fun summer, y'all. It's going to be a good, maybe July 4th would be great. That would be a great day. Anyway, thank you so much. That is the show for this week. Thank you for all your support, all your kind words. Please listen to the Daily Beans weekday mornings for news with swearing as it happens. And check out our new network of shows at mswmedia.com. I've been Allison Gill, and this is Mueller, She Wrote. Mueller, She, Wrote is written and produced by Allison Gill in partnership with MSW Media. Sound design and engineering are by Molly Hockey. Jesse Egan is our copywriter, and our art and web designer by Joelle Reeder at Moxie Design Studios. Mueller, She, Wrote is a proud member of MSW Media, a group of creator-owned podcasts focused on news, justice, and politics. For more information, visit mswmedia.com. MSW Media.